One of the best ways to understand this poem is to know that a proper response to it is, God, how did that happen? How did it happen? Now, what's it? I mentioned before that I believe that the first 11 lines are reminiscent of the first, say, 20 lines of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Now, Chaucer wrote in the medieval period. Chaucer's the first author of major author in English literature. He's the father of the English language, he's called. He wrote in a dialect. And the best way to understand the poem is to see the wasteland as what has become of the world as pictured in the first work of English literature, and that's the Canterbury Tales. Now, how many have read some of Canterbury Tales? Okay, you know it's the first major work. It's about a pilgrimage, a number of people going a pilgrimage to Canterbury, and to entertain themselves, they tell stories to one another. And we get a cross-section of the medieval society in England in that poem. For you guys doing medieval, it'd be great to read. Fun. Earthy parts. Very fun. Okay, I'll just read without further ado what the lines in Wasteland. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Canterbury Tales begins. When April showers with sweetness pierce the root of droughts of March, and make the buds upshoot, and bathe the veins in sap, wherefrom the flowers are born to blossom in these vernal showers. When soft west winds have breathed upon the trees, and tender sprouts appear on all the leaves, and when the youthful sun has run its course half through the ram, the sign of springtime's force, when little birds, so stirred by nature's might, they seem with open eyes to sleep all night, make melody at dawn. When folk also on pleasant pilgrimages long to go, and psalmers want to seek some far-off strands and distant shrines well-known in many lands. Especially from every country's end of England down to Canterbury they wend, the blessed holy martyr there to seek, that will give if they are sick or weak. Now we have a chapel that is journeyed to in the wasteland too, Chapel Perilous. And do we have something there that help will give if they are sick or weak? At the end of the wasteland, he finally makes it to the chapel, and the chapel is empty. No one's there. Mm-hmm. It's a pilgrimage of many voices. Many voices are in this poem. Think of it as a foreign movie, like a Fellini movie, an Antonioni movie. What is it, Godard? What are some others? Yeah, you're the foreign movie freak there. Yeah. Truffaut, yeah. That you're getting scene, 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 right through the thing. There's no continuity. How would you outline this? What's the statement, you know, in a word? What's the development of this? It'd be hard to answer. One other thing to say, and it works in Canterbury Tales. At the prologue of Canterbury Tales, he introduces a number of people that are on the pilgrimage. Now, we will get introductions to a number of people, characters, in the wasteland. And what are they like? Well, first I'll tell you what the characters, some of the, just read three characters from Canterbury Tales. The Knight. The knight was there, and that a worthy man, that from the very time he first began to ride abroad had loved high chivalry, truth, and all honor, freedom, and courtesy. And thus he rode out at his liege lord's war in Christian lands and heathen, none so far. In 15 mortal battles he had been, crusades against the Turk and Saracen, and fought in tournaments and won the prize, and yet although most worthy, he was wise, and in his bearing meek as is a maid, He never had in all his lifetime said an ill-bred word to serf or man of might. He was a perfect gentle knight. The squire. And with him there was his son, a youthful squire. To be a knight was now his heart's desire. He tried to train his hair to curliness. Of 20 years of age he was, I guess, and singularly quick and very strong. In France and Flanders he had served full long, and valiant been, considering his years. He hoped his fame would reach his lady's ears. He wore the latest clothes, the gown indeed quite short, and all embroidered like a mead of springtime flowers. The sleeves hung down at his side, extremely long and very, very wide. Trousers rolled. He's wearing the latest fashion of the time. He played the flute and sang the livelong day. He was as fresh as is the month of May, a well-trained squire, one skilled in horsemanship. He sat a horse with just the expert's grip, could ride in jousts and make his charger prance, compose love songs and draw and write and dance. This lad had fallen in love. By moonlight pale, he slept no more than does the nightingale. Courteous he was, willing and meek, and able to carve before his father at the table. Okay. One more. The yeoman, lower class. The guy who goes with the knight but is of the lower class. And we have lower class, don't we, in the wasteland. One servant had the knight, no retinue, for straight from war he went to pay his due of thanks for safe return. He came back safely. He's going to go on the pilgrimage to Canterbury. This serving man had close-cropped hair and face of swarthy tan, and he was clad in coat and hood of green. A sheaf of peacock arrows, bright and keen, under his belt he carried thriftily, and in his hand a mighty bow had he. A sword and buckler by his side were hung, a hunting horn across his shoulder slung. The baldric was of green, and on his breast St. Christopher in silver kept him blessed. A yeoman was he, and a forester, and knew the ways of woodcraft, I aver, I swear. Okay, pretty solid, right? Pretty solid folks. Now, for the first part on the questions, I'd like you to turn these questions in, you know, these sheets in after you're done. I'd like to see what you've done with them. Let me just read down for the first part. 1 to 11, Bostonian. Proofrock, turned poet. 1 to 11, Bostonian. Proofrock, turned poet. 12 to 18, gal's name is Marie. She's the hyacinth girl. It'll come up later. 19 to 30, prophet, Old Testament. 31 to 34, sailor singing in the opera, Tristan and Isolde. 35 to 37, hyacinth girl, Marie. 37 to 46, Bostonian. 46 to 59, Madame Sesostris. 60 to 76, a poet. Not Eliot. Can't nail Eliot on any of these. Okay, the way I'm going to do this is, I think, to move quickly, is just to read some of the things that I've written in to answer these questions, and then to read the poem, and then to answer maybe any questions that you have at that point. What live images in 1 through 11? What is the speaker's response to them? Live images. You have the lilacs coming. Things are coming out of the ground.
Breeding.
I mean, there's stuff is pushing out of the land. What is the response? Frightened. Spoken by a proof-rockish poet, inhibited, frightened of the spring and its pull to engage him in life. Spring is an incredibly... I get the word is fecund, and I don't know if that's the right pronunciation. Fecundity? It's fecundity, but is it fecund or fecund? What is it, you know?
I'm not sure. I guess I would have said maybe fecund.
Fecund?
I think that's right.
No. Okay. Everything is growing, you know, right? Just growing. He's scared. He's fearful. Clean winter. Snow covers everything. It's not so complex. It's easy. It's easier to live in a mental world in winter. It's hard in summer when everything is pulling at you, moving you toward a way off your course that you decide to set on. Remember the Grishkin poem? Grishkin? Remember? Where he's all excited about Grishkin and repulsed by her at the same time?
Yeah.
Terrible stink, and he'd rather, and we'll... crawl between dry bones to keep our metaphysics warm. Okay, get back to the winter. That's his response to the world. It is in Canterbury Tales, to everything is, you know, bursting. Everything is bursting, greeting the spring. Oh, great, let's go on a, you know, pilgrimage. He goes, spring's coming, ugh. Winter kept us warm. Kept us indoors. Kept us away from the complexity. Okay, two, what kind of world do we have? If asked where one is, they say, I am no Russian. I come from Lithuania. I'm totally German. That's a crazy world, right? The map of Europe after World War I just went, you know, really changed. Really changed a lot. And a lot else changed after World War I. There was a loss, again, of conviction. We've talked about this in Proof Rock. Loss of conviction, faith, purpose. They left many lives rootless. Really rootless. That's like saying, where are you from? I say, well, you know, I'm not a Kansan. I come from Iowa. I'm totally, you know, totally a Washingtonian. That doesn't make sense. Moving, mobile, everything's busted up. Everybody's going all over the place. Well, we're doing that today, so it doesn't seem so strange. But here's a gal who is taken to be a Russian because it's Russian territory, but she's Lithuanian. It really was Lithuanian, but she's German. Germans in Lithuania, Lithuania taken over by the Russians. She's not a Russian, she's a Lithuanian, but she's German. You know, everything is shifting, breaking. It's a crazy world after World War I, really was. What similarities do you find between lines 38 and 40 and some lines in Proof Rock? That's an obvious one. You know, her arms upon the table, braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight, downed with light brown hair. Yeah. The woman with the, I think at that point, I'm not looking at a book now, but it comes in with the wet hair. It's a very positive image, flowers, everything, and speech failed me. I didn't know what to do. I just thought, what to do. What is the irony of 43-45? The wisest woman in Europe is a Madame Sesostris, who has a bad cold, who is a clairvoyant, supposedly, and a clairvoyant who uses tarot cards. Now, all the images in tarot cards are really great at one time. They all have a lot of meaning, but at the present, you know, at the time she was using them, there was no meaning really there. Just little cardboard characters. She goes, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, and says, here's your fortune. What does Eliot do? Here's the fortune. Here are the characters. You know, right through the story. The wisest woman in Europe is a clairvoyant with a bad cold. As Anthony Burgess says, an age that has rejected fertility has naturally rejected religion. It is an age up to this point, it's an age that rejects fertility, fears it, is frightened of it, and it rejects real religion too, and turns to magic, these little games, you know, fortune telling. Which I think in antiquity it's one of the terrible things that you can do is to try to foretell the future. It's one of the most terrible things that you can do. Try to tell the future. Explain 54 to 56. There is no hangman, no Christ. Who is the hangman? Christ. The hangman is Christ. I don't see the hangman. He's not here at all. The hangman sacrificed himself to bring water to the wasteland, and he isn't here. He isn't here. Christ, remember the woman at the well? We had that a few weeks ago. Drink of me, the water that, you know, that everlasting. If you drink me, and you'll never be thirsty again. But he's not here in this poem. The loss of faith, age of the loss of faith. Then I have 5A that I didn't mention, I didn't ask a question about, but Dante, all the people walking across London Bridge, I had not known that death had undone so many. It's a quote from Dante in Hell, and he's looking at all the people. And everybody's walking across London Bridge, and he says, all those guys are in hell. All those people are in hell. And it's a bridge, not over troubled water, but a bridge over dirty, filthy, water. And the contrast between the river in the old days and the river now is one that's consistent throughout the poem, particularly in the poem, the fire sermon section, which is my favorite. Stet means without hope. Stetson, remember? Stetson means without hope. Is there any significance there? Dante saw many that he knew. Remember, the guy finds a guy, and I saw one man that I knew. Well, Dante's doing that always in the Divine Comedy. He's always seeing people that he knew down in hell. I saw one that I knew, Stetson, and he's a man without any hope. And it seems it's a strange, strange passage, because it's the only passage that lets you get the title of that section, Burial of the Dead. Guy buried a person in the garden a year before. Is he sprouting yet? Well, watch out for the dogs, that they'll dig him up. Dogs will dig him up, root him out. And then he calls us Stetson. And he calls the reader a hypocrite. He's addressing us. We're the hypocrite. Okay. We're his brother. You, my brother. My likeness. Hypocrite. You too. But what is the body? Is it a literal body or is it a guilt? You know, we've all, when he says that that's us, we haven't killed somebody, but we do bury the guilt and fear that things are going to be brought up again. There is this bearing. And that's about it. It's a difficult passage, though, for me. Okay, let's read it, and I'll try to... April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over Starnberger's Day with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked an hour. Then the woman, bin gar kein Russen, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. And when we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter. Up in the mountains, a sterile place. No smells. Remember? You walk out here. Doesn't it just ache sometimes because there's no smells? Wait until that first day in spring. Wow, you just walk out, you're knocked right over. But up in the mountains, there's no smells. There's nothing really living way up high. Up on the peak of it, you know, way up high in the air, where all the people go in the sanitarium. Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. You're up way up on the top in the cool air, and there's nothing there living. There's a scene, I've written a poem about that from a scene from Gide's Immoralist. And it's that, you know, fleeing the lowlands up to the highlands, you know, fleeing, and then coming down low again and dying in the spring, and that you can't stand it because it's so, you know, so rich. Okay, and then going south in the winter, nothing's living in the south in the winter. You know, nothing's living down there. It's the sterile part of the time in the winter, even in the south. It's warm, but it's sterile. Seeking out that sterility. Remember a chapter in Aiken's short story, Silent Snow, Secret Snow. And the child wants the world, everything covered, all the complexity, all the life covered. I think some of you heard it when it was read by Steve Harrison. Incredible story, with a guy who just wants to everything covered, can't stand the complexity and the demands. Then the sort of the Old Testament prophet, what are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish, son of man? You cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images, where the sun beats, and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. Now, Eliot will do this. He'll get you going. He'll get you going in a number of passages, and here's one of them. I will show you, come in out of the shadow of this red rock. Come on. In the Bible, that's, you know, Christ or the Messiah is going to be like, you know, everlasting spring, but it's also going to be like a rock, and we to invite us in to the shadow of that rock, cool in the desert. And he will provide that kind of thing for us. He will provide water for us, too. Also, out of the rock comes the spring of living water in the Old Testament. Well, come on. Come on out of that heat, that dryness, and come in here, and I will show you fear in a handful of dust. And you get the image of people like ants, like dust, you know, just trickling through the, trickling, you know, out of life into back to where they came. Just nothing. In a sense, this poem is a heap of broken images. In a sense, this passage is addressed to the poet or the fellow that's writing it. Is addressed there. You cannot say or guess, for you only know a heap of broken images. If you tried to follow all the quotations in this, it'd drive you nuts. Drive you nuts. Out of context, right? Mm-hmm. Snap, you know, it's just like a guy runs through a library and throws them in, you know, breaks, rips off little pieces of thing and throws them together, and there you are, especially at the end.
Yes.
You know, whap, 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 that last, you know, last couple of lines, every line's a different thing. It's a reference to something else. Just flooding this poem with things torn out of the past. But he's looking at the present, and he can't see anything. What's he seeing in the present? As we'll see in the fire sermon. And so he tears these things from the past, you know. One of the things he uses, one of the ways he uses these things from the past is to show what has happened. You know, my God, what's happened to the way it was. The way it was. And it's all gone. In a sense, this is a poem about a poet's bitch because he doesn't have anything good to write about. In a sense. This is a bitch. You know. There's nothing to write about that's good. Can I look at the river and say, write like Spencer? No. Can I look at a love and write like Donne? Can I look at God and write like Donne? You know, he's one of his favorites. Can I look and write a metaphysical poetry that people are going to understand? No, they're going to reject it. You know, can I write about religion? No. Can I write about real love? No. No one will understand what it's about. You know, and it's like, there's a you know, a sort of a gut complaint that's going through this poem. Then I will show you fear in a handful of dust. It's very dry now. You know, he rejected the life, and then it gets very dry in the desert, and then there's out of the past, there's this song, Frisch weht der Wind der Heimat zu, mein altes Kind, wo weilest du, Kari?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you want to address it?
Mm-hmm.
Fresh blows the wind to home. What is the name? Okay, home. My Irish child, where are you crying?
No. Vilas is wandering.
Why are you waiting? Oh.
Carrying, wandering, vilest is a wandering word.
Okay.
Vilest,
where are you wandering?
Yeah. Okay, and that's a song, you know, from an old play. That's the only, you know, that's the wind, that's the water, that's the sailor's song from Tristan and Isolde, and it's out of the past. It's something. It almost sounds positive, but it isn't, and it's in a foreign language, and that's something that you're having here too. Remember at the end, shanti, shanti, shanti. Thanks a lot for that benediction. What does it mean? I don't know what it means. The benediction's in a foreign language. Thanks a lot for the comfort, Elliot. Okay, you gave me hyacinth. Then we're back to this couple. You gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, positive thing. I could not speak, and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the silence. Odent leer das Meer. Sea is bitter and empty. It is not life-giving. Then, break. Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold. Nevertheless, is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards. You know, very ironic. This point. He does not mean that. With a wicked pack of cards. Here, said she, here's your card, and he's telling your fortune. Here's your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Here's your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those were pearls that were his eyes. Look, here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. This is the woman through the whole, you know, thing, the lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel, the three staves supposed to be the Fisher King. And here the wheel, and here is the one-eyed merchant. And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hangman. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking around in a ring. Thank you. If you see Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days. The wisest woman in Europe? What? Here's Belladonna, the lady of the situation. So what? Here's a one-eyed merchant with this card. So what? So what? What's your card? The drowned Phoenician sailor, who was once as handsome and tall as you. Unreal City. You bet. That's become slang now.
Unreal.
Unreal City. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many. I had not thought death had undone so many. This is Dante's description of men who had died before Christianity. Before Christianity. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet. Yeah, you know the scene that much? Rush hour downtown? Even on Hennepin Avenue. And each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him, crying, Stetson, you know, son of no hope. You who were with me on the ships of Mylae, that corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year? Or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence, this animal friend to man, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You hypocrite, lecteur, mon sem, sem, I don't know French, mon semblable, I don't know, semblable, mon frère, hypocrite, reader, my likeness, my brother. What is it, after death, and then you're brought back up to the surface? What is that? What is that? It's a resurrection, and it's not wanted. Don't want to dig that guy up. It's not wanted. What's the live imagery? The dog going after something, acting natural. Watch out for the thing that acts natural, the animality. Watch out for that. It'll dig things up. A game of chess. The most significant thing to remember at this part is that in chess, some of you guys play chess. Do the pieces ever touch? Okay, that's the most significant thing to remember in this part. I'm gonna go on through and not stop until the end because we're half hour first section. We can go faster in the next one, but I do want to get through and then have some time too. I do have to go at 9:30. So, a game of chess. Remember, there, more than anything else, pieces never touch. A war goes on, but there's no touching at all in the whole thing. Another thing, in a game of chess, that the footnote that Eliot gives doesn't help much. It's about it's two people play a game of chess to keep the mother occupied while there's a seduction going on. Remember that one of the best critical notes on The Wasteland that I've ever read is from Anthony Burgess. Footnotes are a bit of a put-on. Footnotes are a bit of a put-on. What do you mean the wood thrush goes, you know, drip, drip, drip? What kind of a footnote's that, you know? Are you kidding me? You know, there are other ones, too. Now, some of them are important. Some of them are, you know, blah, 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 you know, he's doing a little of a put-on, and I think Burgess is on there. And I can believe Burgess pretty well because he loves it, the poem. When he was like 20 years old, he saw it, and he went, wow, and he memorized the whole thing in a day. You know, wow, and he did it. And he got into the poem so much that he wanted to present it to people right away, you know. And in a reading, a choral reading, with that Sacra Printemps, I can't know. It's Stravinsky's Rites of Spring. Mm-hmm. And he said, boy, I want to do that, and I'm going to have the Rites of Spring played while we do it. And everybody dumped on him, and so he didn't do it. But he found out later that Eliot was listening to that on the record player when he wrote the first part of the poem. But I mean, he was into that poem that well. Okay, now what's the questions for this section? And I have that, but I lost it. I got it for Christmas from Sony Hinderly, and because she was at the Wasteland thing last year. But I think it's still back in Minneapolis. I looked all over for it. With three or four words, describe the imagery in lines 77 to 103. Synthetic, opulent, artifacts, things made. The only fruit is gold. Fruit. Arms across the table again, this time jeweled, and the light shines off the jewels. Heavy perfume to the point of gagging. You get into the imagery there about the perfume, and you about, you know, you just really croak. Heavy perfume to the point of gagging, freshened by a little breeze, but that's then the breeze is not talked about anymore. All the art is from the lively past. Carved dolphins swimming. Golden fruit, you know, legend, you know, the Philomel legend. From the lively past, even sorrowful song of the nightingale is no longer what it was then. Nightingale's sorrowful song is always in poetry talked of as jug jug. What does jugs mean, you guys? Jugs.
Jugs?
Jugs.
Breath.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an old thing. Well, jugs. But that's older. But jugs, you know, for kids, you know. Hey, look at those jugs. Okay, in all the old poems, jug is the sorrowful song of the nightingale. Jug jug, to dirty ears. Eh? Okay, first contact with the old myths. What did you react to it, people? Lita gets raped by a swan. Hey, that's a dirty story. You ought to read this. That's the way I reacted to it. Jug jug to dirty ears. You see the rape of Philomel? That's a tremendous footnote on that. That the sister of the wife of a guy is raped by the guy, and then after he's raped, he rapes her, he cuts out her tongue. So she can't tell, puts her in a tower. Then the two sisters finds out about it, they get together. And have the husband in for a banquet, and they kill the oldest son and cook him, and then let the guy eat him. Mm-hmm. After the banquet, they tell him about it. He goes mad, and he starts to stab him, and then he's turned into some kind of weird bird, like an aardvark. And the girls, the women are turned into one the swallow and one the nightingale, and that explains the sorrowful song of the swallow and the nightingale. It's an incredible story. Okay, three or four words. I guess I've had enough three or four words.
Artifacts, fantastic. Withered stumps of time. Withered stumps of time. What lines between 100 and 105 are editorial comments from Eliot himself to show that Eliot's skill at eating his image and having his rhetoric too? Withered stumps of time. Withered stumps of time. He goes through this whole list of this opulent apartment, you know, and what's in there. He goes through that whole thing, and then he says, withered stumps of time, which is a conclusion, right, to the all that precedes, withered stumps of time. Well, in poetry you have two things. You have rhetorical components and image components. Rhetorical component is to make the statement, conclusion. The image components are those things that you can sense. And here and a really tremendous use of poetry is when you combine the rhetorical statement with the image, and then it goes bam, like that. And this is what he's doing, having his image and eating, you know, eating his image and having his rhetoric too, which is a dumb pun on having your cake and eating it too. Anyway, that does both. Why is the imagery of 107 to 110 dynamite? Whose footsteps? Whose footsteps? 108 to 110 in a word or two describe imagery. Footsteps on stair, there's that stair again, and almost, proof rock, shuffles up through the perfume. Imagery is very positive, lively, promising. Firelighter, hair spread out in fiery points, glowed into words, and then would be savagely still. There's another one where he gets you going, and then fear and a handful of dust. He gets you going, very positive, lively, passionate sort of imagery, very exciting, and then would be savagely still. Oh, my nerves are bad tonight. Chop, chop. You know, proof rock turns around, goes down the stairs. No, he doesn't. He stays there. It isn't proof rock. It's a man. He changes and shifts and stuff. But it is a kind of a hesitant, sort of a proof rockish fellow. But it's not funny anymore. There was an element of humor in proof rock because he had a sense of humor about himself, at least at the end. Not in this. There's not the humor. It's too bad. Well, the footsteps on the stairs. He's going to go up. And she's sitting there combing her hair, looks beautiful, and then, you know, oh, my nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Oofta. What is contrasted and compared, 77 to 172? The only real contrast is in class of people in dialect. High class rejects life before it could happen. Lower class shows more basic rejection in refusal to have any more babies. She's wrecked herself with abortive medicines. Physical wreck as opposed to high-class nervous wreck. Physical wreck as opposed to high-class nervous wreck. Comparison, instead of contrasting it, you compare them, they both reject life. They both reject life. Mm-hmm. What is being discussed, 155 to 164? Abortion. The chair she sat in like a burnished throne. This is also like Cleopatra's barge, right? You think the footnote on that. The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeped out, another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of several seven-branched candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it, from satin cases poured in rich profusion in vials of ivory and colored glass. Unstoppered lurked her strange synthetic perfumes, unguent, powdered or liquid, troubled, confused, and drowned, the scent in odors, drowned the scent in odors again. Stirred by the air that freshened from the window, these ascended in fattening the prolonged candle flames flung their smoke into the laqueria, stirring the pattern on the coffered ceiling. Huge seaweed fed with copper, burned green and orange, framed by the colored stone, in which sad light a carved dolphin swam above the antique mantle as displayed as though a window gave upon a sylvan scene. That's the way sends Satan looks into the Garden of Eden. That is a window gave upon a sylvan scene. The change of Philomel by the barbarous king, so rudely forced. Yet there the nightingale filled all the desert with inviolable voice, and still she cried, and still the world pursued. Jug, jug to dirty ears, and other withered stumps of time were told upon the walls. Staring forms leaned out, leaning, hushing the room and closed, with the sense of all the artifacts, you know, on the walls, pictures, busts, you know, pictures, all these things waiting. Footsteps shuffled on the stair. There he goes.
footsteps shuffled on the stair. Under the firelight, under the brush, her hair, spread out in fiery points, glowed into words. What would the words be? Glowed into words. You know, really nice fashion, at least to man, you know, hair, the firelight, brushing the hair, you know, that's a really neat image. And fiery tips, everything glowed into words. Oh, wow. Life there would be savagely still. My nerves are bad tonight. Yes, bad. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you're thinking. Think. I think we are in Rat's Alley where the dead men lost their bones. What is that noise? The wind under the door? What is that noise now? What is the wind doing? Nothing. Again, nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? But, oh, that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant, so intelligent. In contrast, sums up the era of decay that he was talking about here. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down, so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? Purpose? Where's your purpose? None. No purpose. What shall I do? The biggest thing that you can think of is to run outside with your hair down. So, but if there was anything came of that, it would be, oh, my nerves are so bad. My nerves are so bad. And he says, the hot water at 10, and if it rains, the closed car at 4, and we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door. There you have the footman again. Death. We are going to play chess, a game, like a game of life, where we never touch, and we're going to play this until death, without any touching. Ofta. The lady of situation runs regular, you know, runs the love affair, the sterile love affair, runs this love affair, marriage, perhaps, not married, perhaps, but runs it with a regularity. Hot water at 10. It rains, close card 4. We should play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock on the door. Pressing lidless eyes, it's an incredible image. You know, I remember an old song I wrote when I was nuts. You know, concert master, do your fists fit in your eyes? You know, does your soul know how to dance? You get that image that if your eyes are open and seeing it, listening. I don't want to see anymore. See? At the end. Who play chess? Pressing little size, waiting for a knock upon the door. Okay, shift to a pub, right? To a pub. An old crone is speaking. Two women are talking about a third woman. When Lil's husband got the mob, that's out of the service, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself, hurry up, please, it's time. Now Albert's coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you've done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did. I was there. This is in Freudian times. When you lose your teeth, you're losing your sexuality. You have dreams of your teeth falling out, and you're losing your sexuality. Get yourself some teeth. Artificial sexuality, perhaps. He did, and I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set, he said. I swear, I can't bear to look at you. No more can't I said. And then think of poor Albert. He's been in the Army 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give it to him, there's others that will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something of that, I said. You know, then I'll know who to thank, she said, and gave me a straight look. Hurry up, please, it's time. Get out of here, the bar's closing. Is what that line is. The barman, you know, telling everybody to go home. If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique. Ooh, ouch. What a bitch fight. Yeah. So antique. And her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already and nearly died of young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. Why don't you go get married for if you didn't want children? Hurry up, please. It's time. Well, that Sunday, Albert was home, and they had a hot gammon, and they asked me to in to dinner to get the beauty of it hot. To get the beauty of it hot. Hurry up, please. It's time. Hurry up, please. It's time. Good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night. Ta-ta. Good night. Good night. And then Ophelia comes in from Hamlet, sneaks in, and says, good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. And goes off and kills herself in the water, in the river.
Okay, tone of the title in the fire sermon. It's the tone of the title in the fire sermon. What are the two main things fire does? Fire, it burns, it purifies, and then you use the fire of lust. The two main things. It purifies, you can process, and the fires of lust are going on too. So, is there a purifying process that takes place in this section? Is there lust? Where? Where's the lust in here? Where's the lust?
I'll get some water. Be right back. Prime the pump.
Passion, love.
It's a real question whether there is any fire in this fire sermon.
It. The real question, the closest that you could come to it is the carbuncular young man. The young man carbuncular. But we'll talk about that in just a second. Ironic, fire of purification, no fire of lust? No, not really. Not really. It's funny, even the lust in its pure kind, you know, Lewis was great for definitions, even lust, for life, you know, and it's not that, so you got to be aware of things that are for life, because all things that are for life aren't good, but we tend to think that, life, you know, we get to read Zorba next, huh? Zorba's an interesting character, you just love him, and then you really think about it a little, it's like a little bit like Zhivago, makes love to the widow and the next day burns her house down and her kids with paraffin. You say, wait a minute. What's the deal here? Zorba's such a cool cat, you know? He's so cool. He's so great. That's life. But lust, at least, is a lively thing. And the carbuncular young man? I don't know. Okay, the whole poem has an ironic contrast between the fertile past and the sterile present. That'll be explained later. Graceless present. Graceless present. Graceful past, gracious past. In what way is the section about seduction? What characterizes the seduction or seductions? Is seduction the proper word? Now, using the word seduction, you find one seduction around 177, another around 190, another around line 200, another around line 220, another around line 290, and another around line 295. So we get a real good picture of the state of love at this time in the wasteland. Oh, the footnotes say that the Fisher King, Amportus, with the incurable wound, begins this section and then merges with Tiresias. I don't know. He talks up the Fisher King legend a great deal, but as you start following it out, you know, he'll get you going here, you know, and it doesn't ever come. That's something that he doesn't carry it through, and he doesn't want to. He doesn't really want to, and it won't be a consistent thing. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. No one hears it. The nymphs are departed. The nymphs that are supposedly along the Thames, and also it's called the fire sermon, it takes place on the river, right? The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Spencer, from a poem by Spencer in praise of marriage. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The river bears no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed. Who are the nymphs? What's happened down by the riverbank? Silk handkerchiefs, empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, and other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed, and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors. What, on the riverbanks?
Yeah.
What's gone? What in the riverbanks? I don't know. Come from small town. What happened down in the creek bottom? The beer bottles and the... It's not in the Frankie Avalon's beach movies. Huh? I remember seeing it along the Inn River in Austria, and I was 8 years old. And I remember seeing... It was just incredible. Seeing the trail of a rape after it had happened.
Mm-hmm.
I was walking down on the riverbank and I kept seeing these pieces of clothes. You know? And at 8 years old, I say, ooh. You know, I said, wait a minute. What is this? And, well, the nymphs are departed. The nymphs are sort of a jolly thing in the past, you know, in the past ages. And then now you have the cigarette, you know, the telltale signs of summer nights spent down at the riverside. The nymphs are departed, and their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors. That rips it into the present again. The nymphs have become some gals who go down to the bank, you know, riverbank with some guys and have a party. Departed, have left no addresses. Of course not. By the waters of Leman, I sat down and wept. Leman is another name for Lake Geneva, and he wrote the poem there. Also, it comes from the Psalms. By the waters of Babylon, I sat down and wept. And how can one sing a song of God? What is it? How can I sing a song of God in a strange land? And there's this feeling of, where is this? How did this happen? This isn't where I'm from. I don't know this place. It goes through this whole poem. By the waters of Leman, I sat down and wept. That's the closest line that is actually written by Eliot in the poem. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Keep in there. And remember that line is a quote from Spencer's, and the poem is in praise of marriage. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long, but at my back, in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of bones and chuckles spread from ear to ear. Who's laughing? A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank. Now here's your live imagery, the vegetation, right? Nice one, isn't it? A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank, while I was fishing in the dull canal on a winter evening round behind the gas house. That line drove people nuts when they read it in 1921. You know, the mixing of colloquial language with the ancient and very proper language and use imagery. On a winter evening round behind the gas house, musing on the king my brother's wreck and on the king my father's death before him. Now that comes from the Tempest, but it also is an interesting thing to note, and it's supposed to be said by the Fisher King, but then... the king my brother's wreck and the king my father's death before him, musing on the death of Christ and my brother and the death of God my father in this age that has lost its faith. And I sat there fishing, looking for some kind of news, spiritual news perhaps. And the white bodies naked on the damp low ground, and bones cast in a little low dry garret, rattled by the rat's foot only year to year. But at my back from time to time I hear the sound of horns and motors, which shall bring Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They washed their feet in soda water. Sweeney is Ape Neck Sweeney. You know, Ape Neck Sweeney, the guy that could shave while the gal he's with is having an epileptic fit on the bed beside him. That's the description of Ape Neck Sweeney. Absolutely nothing between the ears. Ape Neck Sweeney is a kind of a, you know, a stereotype, but that's Ape Neck Sweeney going to Mrs. Porter in the spring. The song comes from the World War I period, and it's out of Australia. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They washed their feet in soda water. Washing feet. What do you think of? Christ washing the feet. Contrast the scene. You know, God come down. God can come down in man. Goes in, takes off all his clothes except the loincloth around him, gets down on his knees and washes the feet of his disciples. Klutzy guys, dumb, don't understand what's going on most of the time. Feet, in those days they didn't wear shoes, and even if, you know, feet are not the most aromatic, they're aromatic, but it is not in a positive sense. Dirty, filthy, scuddy, crusty. And God gets down on his knees and takes off his loincloth, so he's absolutely naked. God goes absolutely naked. That's humility. Naked in the old days was a big deal. Takes off his thing and washes their feet and dries them. And then gets dressed again. It says you have to do this too. But what's happened to that? And that image is something that even the non-Christians or anything, the only image of washing feet is that. In literature or in anything, washing feet is Christ washing the feet. No one else had ever done it. What's happening now? Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They wash your feet in soda water. And absolutely, it's contrast kind of thing. It's the image that comes to mind, and then you see what's happening here. And that's a song. And it's, and that quote, I think it's in what? It must be Italian or French. And oh, those children's voices singing in the dome. You know, think of the Vienna Boys Choir. You know, all those voices singing in the dome. And in contrast there again to this old song about the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter, as Abe Nick Sweeney goes to pick her up and maybe pick up her daughter too. I don't know. Real contrast again. Twit, 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 jug, 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 so rudely forced. Taroo. It's again another contrast song. Three songs. Unreal City. Unreal City. Under the brown fog of the winter noon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven, with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me in demotic, slangy French, to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. Okay. Tiresias is talking now. Tiresias is talking now, and Tiresias, in the shape of a prostitute, has been approached by Mr. Eugenides to go to lunch and a weekend at a hotel. And you go up and you say, imagine somebody coming up to you and saying, well, you know, would you like to go to lunch and then spend a weekend at a hotel with me? That's what's happening here. Tiresias goes, you know, sees through the eyes of the, you know, is but isn't these people. Is but isn't each of these people. Now, the dynamite passage of the poem. At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the engine, human engine, waits like a taxi, throbbing, waiting, I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears your breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window, perilously spread, her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays. On the divan are piled, at night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I, too, awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives, a small house agent's clerk with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat upon a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious as he guesses. The meal is ended. She is bored and tired, endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have forsuffered all, enacted on this same divan or bed. I, who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead, bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done. I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again alone, she smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. That passage is dynamite, and one of the reasons, and the content of this passage is, you'd never find in older poetry, other poetry at the time. Just incredible. It's really slumming it for the content. It's written in perfectly, as far as metrics and so forth. It's just perfect. The most you know, elegant, technically, just perfect in what he's talking about, you know, really something. Now, going back there, you know, she comes in, she leaves in the morning, she doesn't clean up, she goes off to work, she comes back, cleans up the dishes a bit, takes some food out in tins, okay, this is just more of it, in tins. That's a relatively new thing at the time that this was done. Even the food comes out of tins and not, isn't really real. She's living in one room. She has one, the divan. It's her bed at night. It's a couch. She's washing down her stuff and hung them up in front of the things, blocking the sun, so she can't really see the sun. But it's the things are drying out. Tiresias perceived the scene and foretold the rest. This young man, Carbuncular, Carbuncular means pimply. This young, pimply young man arrives, the small house agent's clerk, a very small job, with one bold stare. Now, you guys, have you ever gone through a time when you had the one bold stare, you know? Or you girls, maybe, I don't know. But the one look, you know, the tough look, the one bold look, and inside you're, you know, you're jello, and then you've got this one look, you know, one bold stare. So cool, you know, the hairy eyeball, real cool. With one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits is a silk hat upon a Bradford millionaire, and you know that. Assurance, cocky, right? Just, you know, nothing can faze you. Absolute vanity. Really cocky. Bradford, we're new rich people, you know. Nothing cockier than somebody who gets a million right away, and then they kind of go, oh boy, they earned it, and they're on top of the world. The time is now propitious, as he guesses, and he figures that it's a good time to work his seduction because the meal is ended, she is bored and tired. Well, now there's a real lover. You know, well, the meal's over, so she's not being eaten, and she's bored and she's tired, and so it's a good time.